Welcome back. This is Sight to the Blind. This whole thing about Trump being a hypocrite when it comes to this narco-terrorism that the U.S. is involved with Venezuela. They've been blowing up boats left and right without due process, without any court proceedings, no arrests, not even using a coordinated effort with the Venezuela police department, just straight spotting boats and shooting them up. And then he turns around a couple of days earlier. It says he's going to pardon the president of Honduras, who was arrested and charged with drug trafficking. If they're doing this in front of your face at this level, that means they're planning something with Venezuela. And we should know that Venezuela has ties with Russia and China. Matter of fact, they are indebted to China. So they're trying to use some type of reach around or go around, pun intended, to go around and try to engage in a war that has to do with the resources that we have to skyrocket. That's all it is. It's not about them beefing with Venezuela or beefing with Russia or China, because we know that Freemasonry is all over this globe. Anybody who's a somebody or a politician or a president, you know they're under Masonic control. So it's not about these presidents, these regimes going after one another for power. It's basically to sell to the public or to hide from the public what's really going on. Now, if they just straight out went to war with Venezuela because of China and Russia, we would know something was up. We would rebel. We wouldn't be managed. Our emotions would be all over the place. It would be like the Vietnam War, how people were protesting in masses because they didn't want us being in that war. They don't want that anymore. Everything needs to be managed. So the way to manage it is to be soft releasing or soft opening the Department of War going after narco terrorists. And because most Americans are pretty much dumb at this point and oblivious to what's going on in the news or even the programs and psyops and rituals that's been put in front of their faces for forever, right, at this point, they're only going to look at it like, oh, terrorists, oh, brown people, oh yeah, we don't want them in our country, oh yeah, keep doing what you're doing, keep blowing up boats. To one day, eventually, what if the boat they blow up, what if the boat that we blow up, America blows up, happens to have a Russian scientist on board or a China scientist on board or something from a different nation that triggers some type of war? If you know that every major war has started off with a false flag, I'm not saying World War III will be will start off with a false flag. Well, it will, but it wouldn't be about nation versus nations. It would be a spiritual war that they're already preparing and planning for. I'm saying that every major war that we've gone into, it started off with a false flag or with a ship being sunk. That's how it started. Korean War, a ship being attacked. World War II, a ship, Pearl Harbor being attacked. World War I, a ship being attacked. They keep reheating the same rituals, reheating the same psyops, because they feel people are so dumb and they forget about what happened months later or months earlier, that you could just keep rerunning the same program over and over and over again because it's working. Nothing has stopped. No one has rebelled. Even when people online talk about, oh, we should just stop going to work altogether, it would never happen. Just like people paying their taxes, their income taxes. Oh, we should stop paying taxes. It'll never happen. It's too many people that aren't willing to chance their financial security, their home security on a movement. Because they feel if it's meant to change, it will change. If we vote to change it, it will change. If we put in better presidents, it will change. People are still under that delusion that man, that the men that you see propagated in front of your eyes as leaders that are bound to oaths, people are blind to think that these people are going to save them out of their misery. And it's like if you watch this religious war that they're having, that they're brewing up, of course you have to know that the guy, the Muslim, the Afghan national, that they had shoot up some poor girl in front of the White House, which of course they have to tell you that she was a Christian. He was brought into this country by the CIA because he was used, just like the Taliban, just like Al-Qaeda, just like ISIS, just like Hamas. They were used for a specific purpose in the Middle East. And so when they started extracting Afghan nationals out of that area, out of that hot region, they knew who they were bringing over here. They were like sleeper cells. So when it was time to instigate this spiritual war, of course, they're going to put out like, oh, he lost his mind. You know that's MK Ultra. Because it didn't even make sense. Like, if you really wanted to do maximum damage, I mean, truly, maximum damage, why not take the AK, stand in front of the White House, and just let off shots into the windows? Why go to a guard? A female guard at that. A white female guard. Who is a Christian. And then have her die on Thanksgiving. It just seems so stupid. If these people were like really mass criminals, like back in the serial killer days, it would make more of a splash than these serial killers ever did in their heyday. You don't understand that? Don't you understand like all these serial killers that used to instill fear, like Ted Bundy, Richard Ramirez, like really instilled fear, the Zodiac Killer? Those days are long gone. Everybody's so managed emotionally, mentally, even spiritually at this point. So there is no like real lone wolves if it's not coordinated by the CIA. She was attacked on the 330th day of the year, 33. Then died November 27th. 2 plus 7 is 9. That's 11-9. If you reverse it, it's 9-11. Ritual human sacrifice in numerology is 9-11. But yet, people in this country are so dumbfounded about what's going on, they rush to Twitter. They rush to social media to express outrage that Islam is taking over. How is Islam taking over? There are literally 2,000 mosques in this country since 2020. Now, even if that number tripled in 5 years, it still wouldn't be the number of Masonic temples that are in this country. The Talmud, Islam, and Freemasonry are all tied to idol worship, and all tied to touching, molesting, or marrying children. This is why you see Christianity starting to pop up with pedophilia now. People being, or pastors being arrested for touching children. Eventually, that's where it's going. Eventually. This is why they have to prop up these Masonic, these old school Knight Templars in front of your face to make you fight for this crusade if you're a Christian against Muslims. Because Jews don't have the numbers to do it themselves. Their war has to be so small in a tight-knit space to make you believe that in a land no bigger than New Jersey, that with all the technology that they have, that they can't find Hamas in a very, 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 very claustrophobic region. That region is so tight and small. That's almost like you not be able to find out who's in Brooklyn if you own New York. If you have all the technology of all the cameras, all the devices to help you spy on people, you trying to tell me you wouldn't be able to spy in on Brooklyn, New York, and not know what's going on? So, of course, they have to keep re-engineering this spiritual war or this war, this terroristic war with Hamas, which you know has got to be the CIA, Mossad, and MI6 all coordinating together to help prove this terroristic threat. They have to keep that going in very small groups and then use Christians to go against Muslims, especially in this country. But they don't even have, Muslims don't even have the numbers to even control anything. Muslims do not run the United States government. Muslims don't run the sport leagues. The Muslims don't run Hollywood. Yet, Americans, predominantly white Americans, have such a disdain for Muslims all of a sudden. Like, it's like clockwork. They like change the channel on the timeline on their FYP, and all of a sudden, now Islam is the problem. One person who's used as a Manchurian candidate, now all Muslims are horrible. All of them that pray 4 or 5 times a day in public, it's so stupid. It really is. Even for that religion, it's stupid to me. To walk around a block 7 times, and there's people that died trying to walk around that block or even walk to that block just to be chewed up by Mossad, MI6, and the CIA. How can he, and there's people online trying to prove that Yahusha was a Palestinian baby who spoke Aramaic, who was more Muslim than Christian, because both books mention him, and I'm talking about the Quran and the Bible, both mention him as a prophet. So everybody's trying to take a piece of Yahusha and have diluted the nation where he comes from, the bloodline that he comes out of. Brother Brock told me about people online that are using Yahusha and Yahuwah, who were once using Jesus Christ and Lord and God, but then even then they're starting to merge the two, just like the Christian doctrine of saying that Jesus is God and God is Jesus. Jesus is the creator. He's the one that created heaven and earth in 7 days. And the reason why they get that doctrine is so you don't have to serve the Father. Even when in the book of John and other, and the also books of the New Testament that Christians love to read and quote, they keep missing where it says, you shall love Yahuwah Elohaka with all your mind, with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. That is the first great commandment. How can Yahusha say, love the Father if he is the Father? Why would Yahusha be on the cross or be on the stake or on the pole, getting ready to die, telling himself, forgive them, they know not what they do? Why would he be praying before his crucifixion, saying, take away this cup of trembling from himself? This is why I don't understand. All you have to do is have even a fifth grade reading comprehension to understand the Bible, to know that these two men are not one. They are one in doctrine, one in belief and faith, but not one person. Never once did Yahuwah said, I'm going to send myself through Miriam, and I'm going to allow myself to be born and be raised as a child into a grown man. There's nowhere in scripture that says that. But this is one argument. Another argument I'm seeing online now is brothers in this truth, they're arguing about who saw the Most High's face. Did Moshe saw Did Moshe see the Most High's face? Did David see the Most High's face? Did Abraham see the Most High's face? Like a whole argument about who has seen the Father and who has not. It's like brothers are so bored at this point that they rather not go in internally to fix their issues or internally to fix if they're worshiping the Father the way he's called us to worship him, or are they just trying to win debates and arguments? Because I've seen that's what's prevalent online right now, is people debating, trying to win arguments, trying to find out who's the smarter Israelite or the smartest Christian or the smartest Muslim. It really is a fool's errand. But that's just what's on my timeline. But the mysteries, there's certain mysteries that come up in my mind that are starting to click with another mystery that I brought out in this show previously when it came to Adam's death. Adam lived to be 930 years old. The Most High told him, all the days of your life, you will eat your bread with sweat dropping from your brow. That you will find no rest all the days of your life. So when Adam died at 930, we know that 7 is the day of rest. We know that the Israelites went into captivity into Babylon because they didn't respect the Most High's Shabbat. He sent them there into captivity for 70 years, which is a sign of the Shabbat using the number 7. So Adam losing 70 years of what would have been a 1,000-year life, also validating what the Most High said, that in that day, you shall die after you ate of that tree. Now, we know in heaven, 1,000 years is but one day. So literally, within that day, within the space of that day, not really coming to the fullness or the completeness of that day, but in that day, Adam died, not achieving rest, which is the symbology of the number 7. Yahusha dies at 33. He doesn't get to the age of 40, which you would know that 40 is all over scripture when it comes to 40 days, 40 nights of the flood. Moshe going up for 40 days, 40 nights. They're in the wilderness for 40 years. Even Yahushua was tempted by Satan when he went into the wilderness, 40 days, 40 nights. So it's something about that number 40. And I wonder that the Most High wanted to make sure the work was done, that the work had to come to completion, that Yahushua wasn't allowed to rest yet because the work needed to be done. I wonder if that was the reason why Yahuwah didn't allow Yahushua to reach, I don't know, 35, 36, 37, 38, 39. Why 33? Why did he allow him to live up to 33? And of course, I think about that number 7, not allowing him to get to the age of 40. Was he removing the rest from his life because his purpose was for this particular work of redemption, salvation, and repentance? I'm not saying I know the Most High. I'm not saying this is how he works. I'm just saying, I'm wondering if this, what was in his mind at the time of making sure that after the work was done, it was done in a way that Yahushua will only see the age of 33. That's what I wonder. One of the other things I've seen online now that just gets under my skin is how many people are trying to attack the Bible through their own ignorance of the stories. One was a girl trying to say that what kind of God is that is so righteous that he would allow King David to rape Bathsheba and not destroy David, but to destroy the child. And I had to comment. I was like, if you read the book of Samuel, the Most High said, if you set a king up over you, he will do whatever he want with your sons. He will send them off to war. And your women he will take for himself. That was the Most High warning the Israelites before they even had Saul. If you want a king, this is what your king will do. So he already laid the groundwork of what will happen when you have kings and not use Yahuwah himself. We wanted flesh and blood. And I talked about in the previous episode, we have a proximity to wanting to see something to establish faith, which is the reason why Christians are the way they are. They need to see their faith on the main stage for it to be believed, or them to be comfortable in their faith. We had to learn this lesson. This is why when the shoe drops, we are looked at as the firstborn. Everybody else will have to learn the same way we learned. They may not have to go through multiple captivities. They will have to learn it through destruction and maybe one captivity. Or however other captivities the Most High has lined up, I'm just thinking of Revelation. It's only mentioning one captivity of he who led into captivity shall go into captivity. And at that time, those who were bringing us into captivity were Jews, Muslims, and Christians. So back to the story. So Yah also told David, as if you follow my laws, my statutes, my commandments, I will make sure, a promise to you and your bloodline, that no other will reign in your stead, that it would only be from your bloodline that will be on the throne. If he destroyed David, then we wouldn't have gotten Solomon. If we wouldn't have gotten Solomon, we would probably end up getting Yahusha from a different bloodline, but this is the Most High's plan. We are in no position to question why he does what he does, why he decided to destroy the child and not destroy David or Bathsheba, or why he didn't save Uriah. We don't have that say. The Most High allows us to have free will. If he has to keep stepping in, we truly wouldn't go anywhere. We wouldn't really have faith. We really wouldn't need to be obedient, because we would eventually take advantage of the fact that the Most High is going to always be around to bail us out of trouble. We would be just as wild, if not already wild, than we were if we would have known that, oh yeah, the Most High will take care of it. He's like our contraceptive. I'll just keep having babies until the Most High removes this from me. I'll stop watching porn until the Most High removes the internet from me. I'll start drinking and getting drunk in clubs if the Most High just removes nightclubs altogether. And that's what people want. People want to be looked at as children without having the responsibility as an adult to practice their faith. So that's why people come out with these weird little challenges to the Most High's ways. Well, why did he destroy the child and then they destroyed David? Because it was a lesson that needed to be learned. David dying wasn't going to serve the purpose of a lesson. And it was righteous because the Most High also gave David judgment that he had to fight all his days, that the sword would not leave his house. The Most High looked at it as, oh, you got time to plan death. You got time to plan. After all the women I allowed you to have, you want this one taken from my servant and you want to have him killed without having your hands on it. Now I'm going to make you fight all the days of your life, that you will not know when your death will come, that you will be in fear of me, in fear of death all your life. That's a little bit more righteous judgment than just removing David altogether. I mean, David should consider himself lucky because he knew what happened to the Israelite that when the ark was traveling and it got stuck somewhere or it was stumbled and he thought that the ark was going to tip over and he put his hand on the ark and the Most High smite him dead and there right then. Didn't give him no leeway. So the fact that David knows this, knew that the Most High was going to strike down at that instant and knew that fear was already in David when he saw that, he still tried to finagle a way to get somebody else's woman by sending her husband to the front lines. So that fear was in him, but he wanted to see how far that fear would actually go to touch him. And the Most High caught him on that. And then he returned to righteousness. But you have to understand it from the Most High's perspective. Even if you can't, try to understand it from the Most High's perspective. Another one is, and this is one I saw recently, this Gentile said that the concept of the genocides and atrocities God commits in the Bible being irrelevant because it's the Old Testament. That statement doesn't even make sense. The concept, no one even talks about the concept of what God did as far as atrocities and genocides in the Old Testament just because it's in the Old Testament, making it irrelevant. That makes no sense. No one has ever said it's irrelevant. You are trying to say it's irrelevant because you can't understand why people would worship a God that participates in the genocide and atrocities of another nation. And you definitely don't read scripture if you don't understand what those nations were doing that would have genocides and atrocities heaped upon them. And I know he's talking about like Egypt and Canaan, because that's the only nations that really got the brunt of the Most High's wrath were Hamites. And I had to be slick with the comment because it was a European Gentile. I said, since when do whites care about black on black crime? Again, if he had this understanding, if a lot of people had this understanding, they wouldn't even care about the Bible. They wouldn't even try to have these arguments of what the Most High did to the Egyptians or did to the Canaanites because they were black in color. You'd be like, oh, this is black on black crime. And you wouldn't even care. Just like people don't care that Crips and Bloods kill each other. They would be using that as a joke. But the reason why Europeans and people who are in religions don't use it as a joke because they truly believe that the Israelites and the Jews are white. And they believe at some point the Egyptians were white. But the reason why the atrocities and genocides needed to happen, because that's exactly what they were doing. They were doing all types of zoophilia, pedophilia, perversions, infanticides, all types of uncleanness. And so as a nation, they needed to be removed. Plus, they were in somebody else's land that did not fall by their lot. Shem told them, told Canaan, do not go into this land because it's for Shem's children. They decided to keep in that land. So whatever happened to them was going to happen to them anyway. It's the same thing with the Egyptians. Oh, why did he didn't just kill Pharaoh? Why did he allow Pharaoh to live and then destroy all of Egypt? Why? Because that's exactly what they were doing. That firstborn curse came upon them because that was Pharaoh's edict, was to destroy the firstborn male children of Israelite women. Then put them in the buildings as mortar when they were lacking in bricks. Then send Egyptian women into Goshen with their children to entice Hebrew children to cry out. And when they cried out, they would leave the Israelite woman's house and go tell the guardsmen. The guardsmen come back, rip the babies from their mothers and throw them into the fields or throw them into the river. The Most High had to save some of the children by allowing their hair to grow so thick that it became a cocoon to them and that he would have them suck honey out of a rock. Then the children that they had in the fields, because the women got so scared of being with their men and men got so scared of being with the women, they would break up. So they would create single family households out of fear. This is why we say America is like the second Egypt. In order for them to keep us away from each other and to keep our family stable, they made us work. They said, this was what the council was in the book of Yasher. If you want to destroy these people, if you don't want them to keep procreating, make their work hard for the men and women so they don't have time to procreate. That is what they did. And you think these people who run America are so smart? They still built Second Egypt, as is mentioned in prophecy. And they still do the exact same things to us now that they did, that the Hamites of a different race, a different nationality, a different nation has been doing to us then. So when they threw the babies in the fields, it'd be the same thing as us being thrown to the swamps as alligator bait. When the Egyptians saw that the babies were in the field, when they were plowing, they attempted to try to plow over the children. So everything they did came back on them. The Most High wanted to harden Pharaoh's heart because it needed to be a sign, a symbol, a standard, a bar for what was going to happen in the last days. This is why, if you understand just a little bit about who the Most High is, he can see time from the past, present, future, all at once. So the reason why he did Egyptian slavery, the reason why he did those 10 plagues, is to set up the last Exodus. If it didn't look like it was going to be a plague or destruction upon the Mitzrayim or upon the Egyptians, then the Armageddon, the apocalypse, the last days really wouldn't hit as much. Because he loves us so much, he wants us to prepare for the ending. So the reason why the first was harsh, so we could be prepared for the second, for when it becomes harsh. Because he's going to turn up the entire world on its ear. The volume is going to be cranked to 10. So because he loves us so much, he wants us to prepare for that. So by reading the scriptures, you know that Egypt was cranked up to 10. So that in our minds, we're already knowing what's going to come. We know what we need to prepare for. We know that we're getting ready to leave. And this is also a sign for those who don't want to leave America. Even the strangers or the Gentiles that sojourning with us. This is what happened to some of the Israelites that didn't want to believe Moshe, that didn't want to believe that Yah sent Moshe and Aaron, that didn't want to obey Yah in the end. They were killed in the 3 days of darkness. They were destroyed. What does it say in Zechariah? Does it not say that the Most High will eradicate 2/3 out of every nation, but 1/3 he will bring through the fire and try them as gold is tried? This is why we Israelites call the low vibrational Negroes the 2/3. They don't want to leave America. The reason why the Israelites in Egypt didn't want to leave Egypt, because they didn't want to die in the wilderness. They didn't want to die in desolation. This is also a clue to know that that northern hemisphere land over there, Israel, is a fake land. Because why would the Israelites be scared to leave Egypt, actually to leave Goshen, which is only a day's walk from Israel? If they knew this is where the promised land is, and they knew that they came from Canaan, and it's not that far away, and they knew they were going back to Canaan. They knew through the prophecy of Abraham that this is the land that's going to be ours. This is the land flowing with milk and honey. They knew it was only a day's walk. It's one day's walk if you actually do the math. If you actually looked it up, I mean, obviously, if you do it on Google Maps or Apple Maps, they don't allow, I think for only Apple, they don't allow for you to actually lay out if you do want to do a walk from Egypt to Israel. They don't allow it, and there's a reason why they don't allow that on your phone. But if you look it up somewhere else in a different search engine, it's literally a 24-hour and some change walk. I wouldn't be scared to do a day walk. That's not a really tracking through the wilderness into a desolate wilderness, especially if you knew where the promised land was. So the fact they knew they didn't want to go all the way back, all the way down to the real Levant, to the real land. But just like Negroes today, they don't know where they're going. They don't know where the real biblical lands are. We know, the remnant knows, the remnant should know where the real land is, so we are already prepared to know where we're going. The Israelites, who are either awakened or not awakened, they will die probably during the 3 days of darkness. And you know people are going to be dying on the 3 days of a blackout. I'm telling you, it's all set up for us to be prepared. Especially when you understand scripture from really an institutional level and you are trying to be one with the Most High, one with Yahusha, and you're always contemplating on the commandments and the statutes, and the Most High knows you're contemplating on his statutes, his ways, and you're trying to search out his ways. This is the beauty of this walk. And this is the level you get to. When you start thinking about the walk, you start thinking about the Most High's ways, not trying to figure him out, because his ways is unsearchable. But the desire to want to know, the Ruach of wisdom and understanding will just bring up certain things for you to ponder on. And that those things literally lead you into a new understanding about how the Most High really built this system and how he wanted us to prepare through his love so nothing will be a shock to us. He even tells us, I have prepared the end from the beginning, so you are not being caught unawares. That is love. Truly, that is love. We don't worship anybody else that has this type of power, that would have this type of love. Especially when we've been running around and running around behind his back so long, so many times. But the reason why we are here, because he knew that we would get to a point where we would understand a little bit of his ways of why he did what he did in the very first captivity. Like, the other nations just got destroyed, watered down, moved. But he wanted Egypt to be that starting point to prepare us. He wanted Egypt to be that playbook for us. So when it all goes down, especially in this time, we will be able to understand. And we're blessed. Truly, we are blessed to be born in a time such as this. Truly blessed. At a time where everybody, just like the Egyptians, just like the Americans will be in shock. That stupor that's going to seize the inhabitants of this earth, it will be a shock. I'm actually very interested in how people who mock God, who mock Yah, or challenge his ways, I really wish that I had like 10,000 phones in front of me where all the people who had something to say against Yah, I just watch them during the tribulation. Watch them when he starts to shake up this world. You're going to see people fold or come to repentance. It's truly going to be a beautiful thing. And for us who are standing in the middle of it, when we are protected, when we are shielded, when our Yeshua starts to shine brighter than religious dogma, that is where you don't say nothing. truly, is when you say nothing. Because when you tried to tell them, they didn't want to listen. When you tried to inform them, they shut their ears up. When you tried to demonstrate that walk, you became gossip in their group chat. Anyway, I don't even want to go too deep into that before this starts like a rant. I didn't even want to go into the previous topic this long. But you know what I'm saying, right? Everything has Yaz planning in it. So I thought it was kind of funny also that Yahusha referred to himself as son of Adam. Son of man. When you see son of man coming through the clouds, son of man, son of Adam. And it's just odd that they both share the ability not to get to the 40 years or having a life cut 7 years or 70 years. I just thought that was odd. It might be something behind that. It might not be something behind that. The only way I would know for sure, if I stay righteous and upright enough, I get to ask Yah these questions and they will be answered. But I want to talk about the mark. The mark. It has been in this world before. If you read the book of Maccabees, the third book of Maccabees, chapter 1. The mark has been here before. And it's coming in the same way that this one came. So let me read you these passages about the mark, how the mark was going to get started in biblical times. Having arrived at Yerushalayim, sacrificed and offered thank offerings to Elohim HaGadol, and done whatsoever else was suitable, to the sanctity of the place, and entered the inner court. He was so struck with the magnificence of the place and so wondered at the orderly arrangements of the temple that he considered entering the sanctuary itself. This is King Antiochus. And when they told him that this was not permissible, none of the nation, nor even the priests in general, but only the supreme high priest of all, and he only once in a year being allowed to go in, he would by no means give way. Then they read the Torah to him, but he persisted in obtruding himself, exclaiming that he ought to be allowed, and saying, "Be it that they were deprived of this honor, I ought not to be." And he put the question, why when he entered all the temples, none of the priests who were present forbade him? He was thoroughly answered by someone that he did wrong to boast of this. "Well, since I have done this," said he, "be the cause what it may, shall I not enter with or without your consent?" And when the priests fell down in their sacred vestments, imploring Elohim HaGadol to come and help in a time of need and to avert the violence of the fierce aggressor, and when they filled the temple with lamentations and tears, then those who had been left behind in the city were scared and rushed forth, uncertain of the event. Virgins who had been shut up within their chambers came out with their mothers, scattering dust and ashes on their heads and filling the streets with outcries. Women, but recently separated off, left their bridal chambers, left the reserve that benefited them, and ran about the city in a disorderly manner. Newborn babes were deserted by the mothers or nurses who waited upon them, some here, some there, in houses or in the fields. These now, with an ardor which could not be checked, swarmed into El Elyon's temple. Various were the prayers offered up by those who assembled in this place on account of the unholy attempt of the king. Only with these there were some of these citizens who took courage and would not submit to his obstinacy and his intention of carrying out his purpose, calling out to arms and to die bravely in defense of the Torah of their fathers. They created a great uproar in the place and were with difficulty brought back by the aged and the elders to the station of prayer which they had occupied before. Now, going into The second chapter, I'm going to start at 27 to 30. No, sorry, 27 to 33. This is King Antiochus coming down to the temple, thinking that because he offered thank offerings to the Most High, that he would be able to just walk in to the Most High's temple. And I'm pretty sure he did this ordinance everywhere he traversed. That going into other nations' temples with thank offerings, pretending to show adoration for their gods, he thought he could do it with us. He didn't see a difference between their idols and our Yahuwah. His purpose was to indict a public stigma upon our race. Wherefore, he created a pillar at the tower porch and caused the following inscription to be engraved upon it: that entrance to their own temple was to be refused to all those who would not sacrifice, that all the Yehudi were to be registered among the people, that those who resisted were to be forcibly seized and put to death, that those who were thus registered were to be marked on their persons by the ivy leaf symbol of Dionysus and to be set apart with these limited rites. Marked. Truly, nothing is new under the sun. We say this a lot, but it rings every single day, every single month, every single season, every single year since the days that we have been woken up. When you pour through the scriptures, when you go through the ancient way and the ancient paths, nothing is new under the sun. So they wanted to mark us with an ivy leaf. Registered. So we had limited rights where they could tell us where we could go and couldn't go. Now, of course, the fake Jews, the proselytes, they were marked for identification purposes to be hauled into these internment camps, these slave work camps. So they tried to mimic, even the own European nations tried to mimic what has been happening to us through the Grecians. And we all know the reason why Hitler came into power and was able to manifest his army through the same devices as the Roman Empire, or really Sparta, really. He modeled his army after the Trojan army. The Spartan army. The symbolism, the eagle, it all comes from Rome. Regardless of how they try to make themselves different, being Ashkenazi children, they still Europeans. They still the bloodline of Yafet. There's nothing escaping that fact. But here, their bloodline, that Yavon, the children of Yavon, the Yavinium, which are the Grecians, they have a bloodline with Yafet. So it doesn't matter what nation they come from, it's the same bloodline, doing the same wickedness. Julius Caesar tried to do it as well. He tried to have a mark, or he tried to give certain citizens who wanted to be just for him a certain, I don't know if it was a mark or a token or something they could have on them. I don't remember, but I know it was something that he wanted his citizens to register to say that they were only allegiance to him. So it's happened a couple of times. To do away with the appearance of hating them all, he had written underneath that if any of them should elect to enter the community of those initiated in the rites, these should have equal rights with the Alexandrians. Some of those who were over the city, therefore abhorring any approach to the city of piety, unhesitating, gave in to the king and expected to derive some great from future connection with him, from some great hope from a future connection with them. A nobler ruach, however, prompted the majority to cling to their religious observance, and by paying money that they might live unmolested, These sought to escape the registration. So we tried to pay our way out of it. Cheerfully looking forward to future aid, they abhorred their own apostates, considering them to be national foes, debarring them from the common usages of social intercourse. And I'm going to skip to the third chapter of 3 Maccabees 25 through 30. As soon, therefore, as the contents of the sefer became known to you, and that same hour we will order those Yehudim who dwell among you with women and children to be sent to us, vilified and abused in chains of iron to undergo a death, cruel and ignominious, suitable to men disaffected. For by the punishment of them in one body, we perceive that we have found the only means of establishing our affairs for the future on a firm and satisfactory basis. Whosoever shall shield a Yehudi, whether it be old man, child, or suckling, shall with his whole house be tortured to death. Whosoever shall inform against the Yehudim, besides receiving the property of the persons charged, shall be presented with 2,000 drachma from the royal treasury, shall be made free, and shall be crowned. Whatever place shall shelter a Yehudi, shall, when he is hunted forth, be put under the ban of fire and be forever rendered useless to every living being for all time to come. Such was the purport of the king's sefer. Truly how wicked these people were, or how wicked these Grecians were. And these are the same people that created the name Jesus, and y'all keep calling him that with no remorse, with no shame to it. You keep calling him Jesus. I get sick of y'all keep saying that even in the comment sections. How difficult it is to say Yahusha. How difficult is that? If I read to you so far what the Grecians did at the time, before Yahusha came into this world, you still call him Jesus. After all what the Grecians have done in the book of Maccabees, you really truly need to read all that the Grecians have done to the Most High's temple. There's no way in the world that the Most High would be satisfied with y'all transliterizing the name of the Messiah, of the Mashiach, to Jesus. A heathen Grecian name. Because that's what they called them in the book of Maccabees. They called the Grecians heathens. Because of what they did to the temple, because of what they did to the children, because of what they did to the priest and children of circumcision. So this whole Mark thing has been here before. And I guarantee you, because of how we are following the law, statutes, commandments, how else will Satan know and have war with us or be wroth with us because we guard the commandments? How will he know that we are guarding the commandments? Because eventually they will see it either by social media or by our neighbors, by our friends. And how do you know, or how do you not know, that your friends, your neighbors won't say, well, they follow something different? When it's time to worship the beast, are you truly comfortable with your neighbors, your friends who are in this world? You truly believe it being comfortable with them, that they won't turn on you? In a time of great tribulation, where bread, resources, even money will be scarce, if they offered people money to snitch on the Yehudim, on the Israelites, what makes you think they're not going to come back and snitch on you for following the commandments? It ain't like they're going to bring us in front of a tribunal or in front of Congress and say, hey, are you following the law, says commandments? No, they're not going to have time to do all that, especially in Satan's short season. They're not going to send armies to root out. They're going to do exactly what people have been doing now, snitching, telling everything and everybody on social media. Have you not understood that social media already is like a social credit score? That everybody's talking about everybody? It's just right now is at its lowest frequency right now because people won't shut up about their relationships. I seen a man come on TikTok talking about how his baby mom needed money for rent. And he says, why didn't you ask your man? doesn't he have a job? And she says, yeah, I'm at work. Yeah, he's at work, but I need $300. He says, the baby father, well, you know what you got to do for this $300. She says, yeah, I know. So he says, I go over to her house 30, 40 minutes later, have her squirting, screaming, telling him that she loves him, that they're going to get back together. He says, oh, I know she's lying. Then he leaves her house. He sees her message or her status on Facebook saying, look at God. And he mocked her the fact that he was the one that provided for her and she's talking about, look at God. Then it was another woman. She's packing up her clothes, her belongings at 3 o'clock in the morning because her man, who is a cheater, has been doing the bare minimum. And I looked at this room that this woman was packing her belongings up in. This brother had a towel and a sheet for curtains. Let me repeat. This man had a towel and a sheet for curtains. Not just one bed sheet across the entire curtain. He had a towel and a curtain. And she's talking about the bare minimum. And she's acting like this is like a flex for her. I mean, people are going to eventually snitch on us. If they're already snitching on people who do the bare minimum, people who are already wicked, what makes you think they're not going to snitch on people who are righteous? Doesn't it say somewhere in Sirach or Ecclesiasticus? Just as a whore is jealous of a right, virtuous, honest woman, so should righteousness. Or so should wickedness be envious of righteousness as well? Or it says something like, I'm paraphrasing. It says something like, just like a whore hates a right, virtuous, honest woman, so should righteousness hate wickedness when it decks herself out in glorious apparel. But it'll be the same thing reversed. That when we become righteous and people see that we're righteous, see that we are following something completely different, and they're probably going to do exactly what they did to those who were vaccinated. Wouldn't you think so? Those that were vaccinated, they gave them French fries. They gave them honor. They gave them glory. Say, oh, how beautiful you are for taking care of your community. And what did they do to the ones that were unvaccinated? We became like the pariahs in our communities. Now, mind you, they didn't put out all the records of who was vaccinated and who was unvaccinated. But they were saying on mainstream media, those who are unvaccinated are the worst. They are the problem. They are the reason why it keeps spreading. You should pick these people out and kick them out of your friends group, or kick them out of your community, or kick them out of your developments. They shouldn't have jobs. They shouldn't be able to go into your grocery stores. That's what they were starting over that little vaccine. So you can see how it's been moving throughout centuries. How the programming is still there. You can see how it comes from somewhere. They just don't make this stuff up. Eventually, if it works somewhere in harsher conditions, it's easy for them to release it because they know the mind state of people has never changed. Even the beginning of time, it hasn't changed. We have not evolved mentally or emotionally. So they can pull back, especially with demons. They can pull back to reach for doctrines and dogma of things that have worked over centuries, especially when they have all the foreknowledge of how people reacted when they implemented taxes, implemented doctrines, implemented gods, implemented sacrifices and rituals. They know what will be accepted in mainstream populations. So it's truly nothing new under the sun. So I just sit here and watch people run their mouth about their social life, their personal life, even their jobs. So I know the day is going to come when they're going to snitch on us. Oh, yo, these people over there are following the law, says commandments. I seen him the other day talking about new moon festivals, new moon feasts. Oh, I saw in his backyard that he was ascending smoke offerings on Sunday. Isn't that the day that the beast has wanted us to make holy? I'm telling you, it's coming. It may not come this year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, but eventually it's coming, or some version of that is coming. Should you stop doing ascending smoke offerings or offerings? No. Daniel didn't stop. And you know what happened to Daniel when they put him in the lion's den? Because he didn't worship and honor their God, that he worshiped and honored Yahuwah. So these situations and scriptures are put in there for a purpose. The Most High loves us so much that he's leaving certain stories in scripture so that we could prepare when we go into the fire or when we go into the lion's den, that we will come out successful. Period. And even if some of us are not successful in life, we will be successful in death, especially when he's given us stories of priests being tortured to death. They are going to be received a crown of glory. Ezra or Baruch talks about this, of seeing the saints who were washed in the blood of Yahusha. Washed, you can might as well say washed in the blood of the Torah, for following and was obedient to it, was given great crowns of glory. So it's a win-win for us. So really, we have nothing to fear, truly nothing to fear, except the Most High himself. Now, I'm talking about years. I'm going to close out with years in Baruch. Second Baruch, chapter 14. And I tell you what I mean when I mention years. Verse 8. But who, O Yahuwah, my Adonai, will comprehend your judgment? Or who will search out the profoundness of your way? Or who will think out the weight of your path? Or who will be able to think out your incomprehensible counsel? Or who of those that are born has ever found the beginning or end of your wisdom? For we have all been made like a breath. For as the breath ascends involuntarily and again dies, so it is with the nature of men, who depart not according to their own will, and know not what will befall them in the end. For the righteous justly hope for the end, and without fear depart from this habitation, because they have with you a store of works preserved in treasuries. I'm going to say this again. For the righteous justly hope for the end, and without fear depart from this habitation, because they have with you a store of works preserved in treasuries. Now, works are a lot. That is a loaded answer. Works. What are these works? The examples are littered throughout scripture. Love Yahuwah Elohaka with all your soul, with all your might, with all your heart, with all your strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. Do for others they can't do for themselves. But there are ordinances, statutes, and commandments that the Most High loves to see you do, smell you do, and observe you do, which is the feast days, new moons, ascending smoke offerings, drink offerings, oblations, the whole works. That encompasses loving Yahuwah with all your mind, with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength. That's what that encompasses. Giving to the poor and needy is also your neighbor. The Most High, Yahusha talked about that in Luke chapter 10. But these are the works. So people are trying to debate me online about, we don't have to do anything, these things anymore, because Yahusha has already done them for us. So we're supposed to be workless, especially when he gave us parables of putting our money to use. And what he meant by money, he meant the work. By putting our work to use and doubling the work, or doubling those who follow the word for our own benefit, to be treasures to us, to be money to us, currency. This is what the work is. When we do the work, gathering souls to the kingdom, that work is put in a treasury. On this account, also, these without fear leave this world and trusting with joy. They hope to receive the world which you have promised them. But as for us, woe to us, who are also now shamefully entreated, and at that time look forward only to evils. but you know accurately what you have done by means of your servants, for we are not able to understand that which is good as you are our creator. But again, I will speak in your presence, O Yahuwah, my Adonai, when of old there was no world with inhabitants, you did devise and speak with a word, and forthwith with works of creation stood before you. And you did say that you would make for your world man as an administrator of your works, that it might be known that he was by no means made on account of the world, but the world on account of him. And now I see that as for the world, which was made on account of us, lo, it abides, but we on account of whom it was made depart. Chapter 15. And Yahuwah answered and said unto me, you are rightly astonished regarding the departure of man, but you have not judged well regarding the evils which befall those who sin. And as regard what you have said, that the righteous are carried off and the impious are prospered. This is for those who have learned through the years. When you see wickedness prosper and you see the righteous fallen. I seen a guy on TikTok sad that the righteous have to suffer in this world, and you see the wickedness and the evil prosper day in and day out, as if they're not ever getting judged by the Most High. This is a comforting for you. And as regards to what you said, man knows not your judgment on this account here. And I will speak to you and hearken, and I will cause you to hear my words. Man would not rightly have understood my judgment unless he had accepted the Torah and I had instructed him in understanding. But now, because he transgressed wittingly, yeah, just on this ground that he knows thereof, he shall be tormented. And as regards what did you say, as regards what you did say touching the righteous, that on account of them has this world come, so also again shall that which is to come come on their account. The righteousness, the renewal of this earth will be for our account. That's why I said, lucky are we to be born in a time such as this. For this world is to them a strife and a labor with much trouble, and that accordingly which is to come, a crown with great glory. We are supposed to suffer for our righteousness in this time, because we are the closing gap. Like I said before, the first Exodus will be like the second Exodus. Wickedness has to come to its fruitful end. If we were in the middle, we would have nothing but strife from day in to day out. From the time we came into this world and the time we left it, we would have nothing but strife. Luckily, we were born in a generation where we're able to come out of the strife of our own wickedness, the stumbling blocks and snares of our own life, to suffer righteously, to truly know what it means to suffer righteously, as Yahushua did, so we can receive this great crown of glory, something our ancestors and our forefathers never get a chance to do, or never gotten a chance to do. We are blessed because we know who we are. We know who Yahuwah is. You remember the days where you thought it was just Jesus and God and Lord. How blessed are we above our ancestors and forefathers to know the knowledge of the Most High, to actually serve him, and not in buildings made by men's hands, not by following Greek and Freemasonic pastors, but actually following the truth for ourselves. 2 Baruch chapter 16. And I answered and said, O Yahuwah, my Adonai, lo, the years of this time are few and evil. Who is able in his little time to acquire that which is measureless? And this is what I love about the Most High explaining. For those who think, oh, we only going to live up till we're 80. Oh, this person live in their wickedness till they're like 99 to 100. Like David Rockefeller had like 5 heart transplants, but he eventually still died. And some people who needed a heart transplant died at 20. at 15. He was able to skip the line 5 times to get 5 heart transplants. But this is what the Most High says in situations like this. 2 Baruch chapter 17, verses 1-4. And Yahuwah answered and said unto me, with El Shaddai, account is not taken of much time, nor of a few years. For what did it profit Adam that he lived 930 years and transgressed that which he was commanded? What was the point of him living that long just so he can sin and remove immortality from his soul? What was the point? Therefore, the multitude of time that he lived did not profit him, but brought death and cut off the years of those who were born from him. Or wherein did Moshe suffer loss, and that he lived only 120 years, and inasmuch as he was subject to him who formed him, brought the Torah to the seed of Yaakov, and lighted a lamp for the nation of Yasharel. Truly, the same could be said for Yahusha at age 33, who didn't come to the fullness of his age. But the work that he did and has done and has been continually to do with our Ruach transcends time and age. That anybody living 930 years couldn't complete this. That even the angels who don't die couldn't even do this. So truly, age means nothing. The years mean nothing. Because to get to what is measureless, to get to what is limitless, to get to what is timeless, is truly based on the path that you have given. We can only hope that we get to see New Jerusalem and New Earth and the New Heaven. But if we don't, we still eventually will see it in the youthfulness of our age. It truly wouldn't matter if we are taken out of this world at the time of the beast comes. It will still be, it would feel like we went to sleep for a second. We are at the end where the end is already at the end. So those who will be sacrificed for the Torah, it would feel like a blink of an eye. And we would wake up for the resurrection. Hopeful that we attain what is measureless and timeless. If those who are lucky to be born and live on through apocalypse, through Armageddon, through the unveiling of this world to get the new world, the new heaven, new Jerusalem, how beautiful is that also? Did you get to behold that with your eyes? Your children, if you raise them upright, will get to behold this with their eyes. This is what we're preparing them for. This is what the work is in your own households. But it also starts with you. The things that are coming are easy to be seen at this point. Truly, it's easy to be seen. How they're getting Christians to go after Muslims, because the Muslims are being used as a tool to incite Zionists, and all the while, the Catholics are in the back saying absolutely nothing, because they are supposed to act like they have the keys to the kingdom. So they can't be seen pulling any strings. So when the Antichrist jumps on the scene, it won't be no Judaism, Islam, Christianity. It would be the beast religion with the Roman Catholic Church at the head of it. Like I said, it's easily seen. They have to finagle it or put it in front of your face in a way where you can digest it, to where you don't think this is the Bible happening real time, but there's no denying that this is scripture. They're just giving you color commentary with these little drug boat blowing up events. Oh, they're going after Venezuela. The whole time Nicolas Maduro been over here to Miami back and forth. Unimpeded, back and forth to Miami here. Now all of a sudden we beefing with him. They got Jared Kushner talking to Vladimir Putin. Like I said, it's moving. They're just giving you color commentary to make it make sense that they are in control. And that's all they've been doing. Pretending like they are in control. By the way they boast, by the way they talk, by the way they act. But we know they aren't in control. They are merely puppets. Mouths. And we know what hand is up their backside working their mouths like a puppet. So nothing that's going on in this world should ever stop us from doing what is necessary in our own households. Storing up treasures of works. So when our time comes, we have more on the altar than anybody else who said that they know the Most High God.